From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. If you've ever applied for a temp job, you know, it's a little weird because a lot of the time, you don't even know what job you're applying for. You just fill out a form with your work history and skills and wait for a call. The temp agency looks for a company that needs someone like you. It could be an office job, factory work, construction, almost any job out there. But sometimes it's not your skills they care about.
The construction company, they will call in the morning and says, I need like 10 laborers. Do me a favor. Do not send me any monkeys. Send me crackers. I don't want any monkeys on my site.
These are the kind of calls some temp agencies are getting from their clients. Hiring workers based on their skin color isn't just racist, it's illegal. So sometimes temp agencies rely on code words to hide what's going on.
Basically, they refer to people as either a vanilla cupcake or a chocolate cupcake.
They will say, like, no kitties. You know, like, don't send me no kitties, which they refer to homosexual people or women.
That's what's crazy, is it's not really a code word. I mean, it's everybody knows what the hell it means. You know, I mean, big hands, small hands. Big hands is man, small hands is woman. You know, blue eyes, you know, brown eyes, you know, that type of thing.
Our reporter, Will Evans, made these recordings as part of an investigation we first aired in January. You might not think it would affect that many people, but the temp industry has come back strong since the recession and now employs as many as 14 million people a year. We're going to spend the next hour revisiting our reports on this type of discrimination and tell you what's happened since our stories first aired. We begin in Tennessee with two sisters born in Russia who ended up recruiting workers for a temp agency that handles, well, all sorts of requests. Here's Will.
Oksana and Anastasia Istomin are chatting with me in their apartment in Chattanooga, Tennessee. They point out this painting on their living room wall. Giant rock formations jut from the sea, silhouetted by the sun.
That's where we're from. That's
the Sea of Japan right there.
My grandfather painted that.
It's beautiful.
Dad's dad. And the one by the door, he painted that one as well downstairs.
Oksana and Anastasia were born in Nahodka. That's in Russia's Far East. It was during the Cold War. The sisters' parents were religious activists, part of an underground Pentecostal church. And at that time, Soviet authorities were cracking down on Protestant Christians and others they saw as a threat. Oksana is the older of the two sisters. She's 37. And one of her earliest memories is of a late-night visit from the KGB.
So they dragged my dad out of the house by his hair, out of the apartment. And we didn't see him for 6 months, didn't know if he was alive, dead, where he was.
Their father eventually got released. And after many years of trying to leave the Soviet Union, the family got refugee visas that allowed them to immigrate to the United States. They ended up settling in southeastern Tennessee in 1990. Their parents had heard that people here took their religion very seriously.
The buckle of the Bible belt.
They talked about that.
Oh, that was the selling point.
All grown up, the sisters also ended up working together, just across the street from their apartment complex, at a place called Automation Personnel Services. It's a staffing company with branches across the South. It provides temp workers for offices, industrial plants, and warehouses. At Automation, the sisters were recruiters. They'd interview people looking for jobs and take down their information. And when an order for workers came in, it was the sisters' job to go through their stable of applicants and find the right match. But it wasn't long before the sisters started getting unusual requests from an Automation sales rep. Here's Anastasia.
She called me on the phone and said that she had an order and said that they wanted, you know, the usual country boys. And I said, no, I don't know. So she started saying that they like white guys over there and not to send anybody black.
This type of request wasn't written down. It was supposed to be subtle.
They would try to make it sound, I guess, more gentle or delicate than it actually is. And they would say, you know, country boys, the usual.
It sounds a lot nicer than no black people.
Yeah.
And the temps have no idea, right?
Oh, God, no.
Oh, absolutely not.
No,
absolutely
not.
To be clear, Automation would hire African Americans. They'd just send them to the companies that would accept workers of all races. And if there wasn't an opening that day, those black workers would be out of luck. And it wasn't always just about race. Some companies only wanted young workers. Others wanted men. Still others requested women.
How often did that did that kind of stuff happen?
On a daily
weekly,
basis.
Weekly, daily,
all the time, all the time. To the point of where it was just common.
Remember, in the Soviet Union, the sisters and their family were singled out and treated harshly. That's why they came to America.
I know what it's like to be persecuted and to see American citizens be treated like shit because of the color of their skin. Is just, of all countries in the world, this is the country that it shouldn't be happening in.
Temporary jobs are one of the fastest growing parts of America's economy. But I was finding that hiring discrimination among staffing agencies is a big problem. I came across automation when I turned up two recent lawsuits where former recruiters accused the company of discrimination. One settled and one was thrown out, but I was struck by a similarity. Both recruiters said they were told to send only white workers to certain clients. So I started reaching out to people who'd worked at automation. I found the Istemann sisters. And then I spoke to Christy Ragland. She was the office manager at a branch in Kennesaw, Georgia. It's a bit hard to hear her because of the phone connection. She's describing one of automation's customers.
He would call and say things like, he didn't want any black thugs. That's exactly how he would say it.
No black thugs. And the guy who said this, Christy says he was a manager at Magnum Products, a company that makes drywall compound. He wanted workers, but only white ones.
I didn't like it. Me personally, I tried not to deal with him because I am African American and it made me feel a certain type of way.
But Christy says her boss at Automation told her to give the manager what he wanted.
Yeah, she sat down and had a conversation with me about him and said that he's one of these special type clients. And she said he's racist as hell. That's exactly what she said. But, you know, at the end of the day, he helps out billable hours and he's looking for a certain type of person and we have to send him exactly what he's looking for.
Christy says she was fired in 2015 after telling her boss that she didn't want to be office manager anymore. As for that drywall company, I spoke with a manager there, not the guy Christy was talking about. He called the allegations hearsay crap. I talked to more than two dozen former automation employees who told me this type of discrimination was common. The people I talked to were recruiters, office managers, and sales reps from six states. They told me automation would often send out temp workers not based on their experience or skills, but because of their race, age, or gender. It was simple. Whatever a hiring company wanted, automation would deliver.
What you're describing is the typical situation that's found all over the country, many different staffing agencies.
Mark Bendick is an economist who's also testified in discrimination lawsuits. I turned to him because he's done some of the only studies that try to quantify job discrimination in the staffing industry. And for his studies, Mark uses undercover testing. A team of researchers pull together lots of people, usually college students, and pick two who seem the most similar, except one of them is black and one is white. They give them virtually identical resumes, have them dress alike, and even train them to talk the same way.
So that by the time they're ready to go out and look for jobs, an employer has little to choose between them. In situations like that, unfortunately, we've observed discrimination as often as two times out of three with employment agencies.
I put these findings to the Staffing Industry Association, and an official there disagreed, saying this kind of discrimination is very rare, at least no more common than in any other industry. But Mark says he's found that the rate of discrimination in the temp industry is actually higher than when a company selects its own workers.
Employers often select staffing agencies specifically to do their dirty work, to discriminate for them. The employers like to think, well, if we just hire from the pool of people who are sent to us by the staffing agency, then we're not discriminating.
So why does this happen anyway? Mark says it's often driven by bigotry and stereotypes, that people of a certain race or ethnicity work harder than others.
Automation Personnel Services is one of the most admired companies in the staffing industry, specializing in light industrial and administrative clerical opportunities.
Automation was founded in 1990. As the temp industry boomed, automation boomed right along with it. In 2014, the company hit $180 million in revenue. Automation's president, Steve Nordness, built the business from scratch. And he's an interesting character. He's known for a speech he gives to all his employees about how he once fired an entire branch office for discriminating. We wanted to be sure to talk to Steve. We spent weeks calling and emailing. We went to his office and his house. Eventually, a PR company sent us this audio tape.
Let me tell you about Automation Personnel Services.
That's Steve.
We have a very strict zero-tolerance policy against discrimination. It isn't just illegal, it's immoral. That's why we train all our employees on Steve's rule. The rule states if any employee acts against our guiding principles, not only is that person subject to termination, but the entire office as well.
Steve's story about firing an entire branch is something of a legend at Automation. So I tried to get more details from company vice president Randy Watts. When did Steve fire an entire branch?
To be honest with you, I don't recall exactly. It was probably more than 10 years ago.
Do you remember what the issue was?
I really don't, other than it was a violation of our hiring practices.
But it was discrimination.
Again, I really don't recall. It was a long time ago.
Do you remember where?
I don't, to be honest.
It's clear that Automation has an official policy against discrimination, but I was hearing something different from people who worked in its branch offices. Candy McDermott was an office manager for Automation in Huntsville, Alabama. Just after coming back from corporate training and hearing about Steve's rule, Candy says her supervisor took her aside. The supervisor explained that some of Automation's clients had special requests.
And she would say, "No, we can't put this in the computer. But I'm telling you, they're only going to take these type of people. They want women. They want Hispanics. This is just between us. We can't tell anybody we're doing it."
Some of these requests came from small regional companies you've never heard of. But Candy says they also came from one of Automation's biggest clients in the area, LG Electronics, the huge South Korean company that makes everything from washing machines to cell phones.
We're just coming off the freeway here in Huntsville, Alabama. There's the LG warehouse right there, big LG complex. Got the American flag, the Korean flag, and the LG flag.
LG's operation in Huntsville is one of the company's largest in the U.S. and is located in a special customs zone. The company keeps its labor force flexible by using lots of temp workers. Candy McDermott said the operation is so big that Automation has a staffing coordinator posted at LG.
The coordinator that was out there would actually call and say, "You know, they only want Hispanics." That was the request. They had to be Hispanic.
Four other former Automation employees also told me that LG specifically wanted Latinos and got them. Sandra Keith, a former Automation recruiter, told me these orders were coming directly from an LG warehouse manager. She says she knows this because he told her himself while she was posted at LG.
Don't know exactly what his reasons were behind that, but he would just flat out say, "Hey, we need some more Hispanics," or, "Hey, we need some more Mexicans over here. You guys got any?" Those would be like his exact words.
So you were expected to basically comply with that request?
Yes, nothing more, nothing less.
Do you think that any black workers, white workers didn't get jobs as a result?
Absolutely. Absolutely. With that particular company, absolutely.
LG declined my requests to visit the warehouse and talk to managers. Instead, I spoke with John Taylor, Vice President for Public Affairs and Communications. I told him what I'd heard about worker discrimination at the LG facility.
I'm not sure what a few former disgruntled employees may say, but the fact is that this is not in accordance with our policy. And, if we did find that this was going on, it would be dealt with swiftly and strongly.
He said LG investigated and found nothing wrong.
I wish we could help you with your story, but it just doesn't seem to be anything there.
Automation officials told me the same thing. They had investigated in Huntsville and all those other branches where I'd heard about problems. They found no proof of any discrimination. Kelly Breckenridge is Automation's corporate counsel.
I'm not an easy person to get around, believe me. And I can say with confidence that APS does not discriminate.
Both LG and Automation did say that the workforce at the warehouse is overwhelmingly Latino. Both companies pointed to a high concentration of Latinos living nearby.
That particular customer you're referring to is in an area that's demographically more Hispanics than any other.
There are some neighborhoods not too far from LG with large numbers of Latinos. But Automation recruits workers from around Huntsville, not just specific neighborhoods. So here's the problem. According to Automation, 75% of the temp workers at the LG warehouse are Latino. But according to U.S. Census data, the Huntsville area is less than 5% Latino. There were a bunch of people at the Huntsville branch who found working at Automation distasteful. Sandra Keith quit her job there. So did Candy McDermott.
It was like routine. I left work, I came home in tears. I would walk straight to the bathroom and hurl my guts out. Before I went to work in the morning, same thing, sick to my stomach.
Because of?
Just you knew what you were going to go through that day, what you would have to do to earn that paycheck.
This is actually a big theme that emerged in my reporting. A lot of these recruiters started out really believing in their work, feeling enthusiastic. They were helping people down on their luck get a job.
One of the most important things in life, you know, is having a job.
That's Oksana Istomin again. We met her and her sister Anastasia earlier in the story.
And to have an opportunity to help people improve their life, that's why I got into recruiting.
And then they find themselves stuck in this terrible position, having to lie to job applicants, telling them it just didn't work out, but knowing that the real reason was their race or gender or age. Many of the people I talked to said they went along with the discrimination because, well, they needed a job too. And if they didn't give customers what they wanted, they thought they'd get fired. Oksana says she tested out that theory. It was in 2013. She got a request for a warehouse worker from Chattanooga Shooting Supplies, a gun wholesaler. It was a last-minute order, and only one qualified applicant was available.
He had the skills, he had the experience, he was dressed appropriately, and he fit the perfect criteria for what they were looking for. Except for one thing, he was Indian.
According to Oksana and her sister, this was one of those businesses that wanted only country boys. I called them to confirm what the sisters told me, but a manager referred me back to Automation. Oksana says she was ready to send the worker to the warehouse. Just then, her boss called her into her office.
And I explained to her his qualifications and everything. She said, I don't think it's a good idea to send him. And I said, why not? And she said, well, I don't think he'll feel comfortable there. I said, well, can you please explain to me why he wouldn't feel comfortable there? He's here looking for a job and he's willing to go. You know, she's like, well, they prefer somebody, you know, who's white. I reminded her of what Steve said, the president of the company, about taking, racist orders, basically.
So Oksana says she sent the man anyway. A week later, she says Automation fired her, supposedly for some unrelated reason, not showing up at a job site. Oksana says it was made up, but she didn't even fight it. She was done, and she doesn't regret it.
Honestly, I learned a lot in this industry. And I know exactly what I'm willing to do and what I'm not willing to do. And it took me working there to realize that. That just completely is such a double standard for me personally. You know, me being here in this country for the opportunities and denying people the same opportunities, you know?
That story was from Reveal's Will Evans and Michael Montgomery. Since the story first aired, Automation hired an outside investigator and has set up an anonymous tip line for employees to report complaints. CEO Steve Nordness told us their response isn't just lip service. He said they're going to be real-life changes that will make Automation a better company. But recently, the company told us they concluded the investigation and the results are confidential. They wouldn't say anything about what they found. The government also has some responsibility here. Our investigation found the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, has received complaints about Automation Personnel Services. But everything the commission investigates is kept secret unless there's a lawsuit. So far, that hasn't happened with automation. We do know that an EEOC investigator started following up on our findings. We spoke with the chair of the EEOC, Jenny Yang, and she confirmed a lot of what we found out about the temp industry.
We do see significant job discrimination continuing. And one of the concerns we have about the growing temporary workforce is that those workers are now some of our most vulnerable workers because they can't be assured they have a job the next day. We had a case, for example, where this temporary agency had classified their workers and they would comply with discriminatory requests by the employer. And when two employees opposed that discrimination, they were fired. And so this employer would use photos of the temporary workers to determine their race and gender. And then they had code words. So, for example, they would say hockey player, vanilla cupcake, or someone like you and me. Or they would, you know, use a W or a smiley face to signal that they preferred a white worker.
Why do you think this problem still persists? I mean, at this point, you think it would die off.
Well, I think for us, addressing the problems in the temporary workforce are even harder than in other employers because the information is harder to identify. You know, workers at one employer may actually be placed by many different staffing agencies. So if you are investigating the source of the problem, there are many different pieces to the puzzle, many different responsible parties, and it is much harder to try to establish what is going on in a particular employer.
You've got a case backlog of some 75,000 complaints. Do you have the resources necessary to deal with that type of backlog?
Well, unfortunately, the demand for our services have always exceeded our available resources. We currently have what we call our workload of 76,000 charges, and we have about 550 investigators who are fully trained to handle this caseload. And on average now, a filer waits less than 10 months to get a resolution of a charge.
What is it about the temp industry that basically this type of discrimination is able to flourish?
I think there are a number of issues. Because many employers are now relying on a staffing agency to send them their workers, they sometimes mistakenly believe they are not responsible for either the working conditions of those workers or for the types of hiring that's done. So they think they can perhaps insulate themselves from responsibility for discriminatory criteria when in fact they can't.
Have we failed in tackling this problem? And if so, you know, what are the tools that we can use to change that?
There remain many biases, right, that people have stereotype notions about who's going to be successful in a particular type of job. And unfortunately, what we've seen is that often people rely on those notions rather than giving people a chance based on their experience. And we've seen that in the staffing agency where, in particular, staffing agencies are refusing to place African-American employees based on their race, and they are terminating employees when they complain about that, as well as limited assignments that individuals may have. So that is something that we see recurring, and we want to be able to provide opportunities for all workers, and we think this is a very important area for companies to be looking at.
That was Jenny Yang, chair of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Now, we found lawsuits across the country against temp agencies and employers. Some were filed by federal regulators, others by workers themselves. Recently in Chicago, lawmakers tried to come up with their own solution, but they ran into unexpected roadblocks. That story next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey folks, it's Cole Goins here from Reveal. Every Monday, we send out an email newsletter that's filled with behind-the-scenes perspectives from our stories, top investigative journalism from around the world, and more exclusive insights from our newsroom that you can't get anywhere else. In this week's newsletter, we're talking to reporter Will Evans. He'll answer some questions that remain after his investigation into the temp industry, the one you're hearing right now. Subscribe to the weekly Reveal so you don't miss out on all the action. Just head over to revealnews.org/newsletter and get these stories straight to your inbox. That's revealnews.org/newsletter.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Supplying temporary workers or staffing is now its own industry and one of America's fastest growing in terms of jobs. Ground zero of blue-collar temp work is Chicago. It's where the first modern industrial staffing company was founded 70 years ago. Today, the Chicago area has about 900 registered temp offices. Many are large hiring halls with long wooden benches. Some workers are selected quickly. Others might spend the whole day sitting and waiting and waiting. And this has created tensions between Latino and Black job seekers. Here's a story from January, reported by Chip Mitchell of Chicago's WBEZ.
Who's been working on these issues now for 12 years, right?
Leone Bicchieri is like a lot of labor organizers. He talks up what workers have in common.
We're all workers. We all get up in the morning and sell our labor to someone else, right? Yes.
He wants them to feel a sense of togetherness.
We're going
to
clap real slow at first and then get faster and faster. Ready? Real slow at first.
But clapping is one thing, real solidarity another. Leone's at a community center on Chicago's west side. He's talking to about 50 workers. They're all temps, so a lot of them won't be around for long. Another thing is that some of them are Latino and some are African American. And here's the really hard part. To get them working together, Leone's got to ask some of them to make big sacrifices.
Si se puede, se puede.
Si se puede.
Can we do it? Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
Now, I'm going to talk about those sacrifices and which workers would need to make them. But first, I got to tell you how Leone got into this situation. There was this group called the Chicago Workers Collaborative. It focused mostly on Latino temps. Leone became executive director about 6 years ago, and he proposed reaching out to more African Americans.
It just felt to me like in this economy, we're not going to have as much pressure as we possibly could have to reform the temp staffing sector until we have workers of all backgrounds united.
He hired the group's first Black organizer. He moved the group's main office to a mostly Black neighborhood.
It forced us to talk with African-American workers, not just now and then, but every day.
And what Leone heard surprised him. While the Latino workers' main concerns were getting cheated out of pay or harassed by a boss or injured, the Black temps said their problem was getting assigned to work in the first place. One of them was Kenny Flowers, a 39-year-old father of five.
What you doing, man?
I went with Kenny one day to this office. It was in a strip mall just outside Chicago.
I haven't had a full-time job in about 9 or 10 years.
So he was trying for temp work in a factory or maybe one of those industrial bakeries. Chicago has a lot of these kinds of jobs. The temp agency waiting room was overflowing into the parking lot. It was around noon, and the agency had already filled most of the day's jobs.
Well, I tried like 3 days straight to get work here, and I didn't get sent out.
So on this day, nearly all the people left waiting were Black. I asked Kenny what he thought was going on.
I see more Latinos going out than I do African American or any other race.
Why would that be?
Because they're not documented.
Not documented as in not living in this country legally. Kenny said the Latinos get the jobs because they're less likely to complain about pay or conditions. So that's the sort of thing Leone heard from African Americans. At the same time, he heard resentment from Latinos in his group, resentment about Black workers.
That they can get all these other public subsidies if they don't work. They can get food stamps, they can get unemployment, they can get all this stuff that I don't even know about. I can't get any of that because I have no documents.
Leone says the Latinos see the African Americans.
That some of them have been here 2-3 days in a row at 4 in the morning. But guess what? I'm going to get on the van at the temp agency if I'm allowed to get on the van.
Now, if anyone had the experience for organizing across racial and ethnic lines, it was Leone. For nearly his entire adult life, he'd been working with people at the bottom of the labor market.
Organizing farm workers, organizing poultry workers, meatpacking workers, janitors, lots of Latinos and African Americans, and lots of tension.
So why would anyone throw themselves into this kind of racial tension? To understand that, we got to go back further. Leone's parents were both immigrants, his mother Mexican, his father Italian. They got divorced, and then
my mom remarried to Gary.
Gary Fleming, who was African-American. Leone says his stepfather had a big influence. There was this one time.
I was 9 or 10, playing with some friends, and Gary was sitting on the doorstep. You know, he was kind of within earshot. I think some of the kids were making jokes about Jewish people, about Asian people, probably about a lot of different groups.
His stepfather called him over.
And I said, well, but we're just joking, Gary. It's not like we really think that. We're just screwing around. And he said, but you see, Leo, think about it for a minute. I'm black. Your mom's Mexican. He's like, you're a little guy. You may not notice this, but a lot of people don't like that we're together. He said, it's very dangerous to go along with those kind of stereotypes because they can lead some people to use that and divide us and hurt us. And you wouldn't want that, would you? And I said, no, Gary. Could see how upset I was, and he picked me up, and I sat on his lap.
Leone's stepfather had grown up in the 40s and 50s as the civil rights movement was getting off the ground. As an adult, he'd worked in anti-war and social justice campaigns. Leone says he was always posing this question.
Who wins when poor people are divided?
So years later, Leone was trying to bring these Latino and African American temp workers together. At least that was the goal. He knew that they'd first have to feel safe. So he started by having them go to separate meetings to air out some misconceptions.
I got you mixed up with warehouse. Yeah, warehouse workers.
This meeting was on Chicago's South Side in a black neighborhood.
You know, I just wanted to say a couple words.
Leone brought up a common complaint the black workers had. It's about how the Latinos seemed to get treated better because the people who ran the temp agency spoke Spanish to them. Leone told the black workers they might be surprised at what the Latino temps were hearing.
Stuff like, get your asses on the bus or I'm going to slap y'all. I mean, it's,
really?
They treat them really bad. They don't pay them. A lot of the women get sexually molested. And then when they start to complain, it's like, I'm going to call immigration, man. Right? And some of the Latinos born here, they get, I'm tired of you saying stuff. I'm going to call your PO.
PO, like parole officer. The same threat the bosses use on black temps just out of prison, he said.
Look how they do us, man. It's almost the same thing. It's just like...
So some of the workers at these meetings, both the black and Latino temps, they became Leone's troops in an anti-discrimination campaign. They leafleted outside temp agencies. They helped other workers fill out forms so they could make legal complaints. And about a year ago, they decided to take their battle to the state capitol. They helped create legislation that would require temp agencies to keep records on the race, ethnicity, and gender of all job seekers. Leone said it could be as simple as a contact sheet with checkboxes.
Half page, however we can do it, super easy.
That way the agency could be held accountable if it discriminated. Leone led dozens of temps in a lobbying effort. The bill passed the Illinois Senate in the spring of 2015. Then it came to a House committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm presenting Senate Bill.
Representative Kenneth Duncan sponsored the bill in the House. His district stretches through some mostly black neighborhoods of Chicago.
The reason that we're here is because there's been a problem with English-speaking citizens coming into these temporary agencies, but they choose a non-English speaking, possibly someone who may be a U.S. citizen or not, and they treat them like crap.
Not long into the hearing, the staffing firms made their case.
I represent Dan Shulman. I represent Staffing Services Association of Illinois.
That's a trade group of 25 blue-collar temp agencies.
This mandate will cost millions of dollars for small businesses in Illinois and result in a loss of jobs, because it adds a massive paperwork requirement to the industry.
He also objected to the fact that the job applicants themselves would be identifying their race.
I support getting legislation that would have correct data, but we're going to have false data about race that is going to be used for litigation. So I would appreciate a no vote. Thank you.
Okay, staffing companies didn't like the bill. But what happened next caught Leone's group flat-footed.
Representative Royal. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Luis Arroyo represents a Chicago district that's almost two-thirds Latino.
You don't have to have legislation to do this because you're hurting people in my community. You're hurting the people that I'm putting to work in my community, and you're hurting a lot of these agencies that are majority probably in Latino communities. Should they hire more Afro-Americans? Maybe so.
At this point, the conversation got more heated.
This is not about African-Americans. This is about a simple identification.
What does the bill say? The bill says that you have to identify
the ethnicity. It's not about African Americans. It's not about white. It's about who is in front of me that's applying. And that's really what it is. It's a checkoff box.
If it isn't about Afro Americans, how come you don't have maybe some Latinos that are complaining or other people?
When his bill started going up in flames, Leone wasn't at the hearing.
I was driving early in the morning, cup of coffee.
His stepfather, Gary Fleming, the guy who had schooled him about racial divisions, he had passed away.
Just coming out of the funeral home, cremating my stepfather's remains.
Leone's staff told him on the phone about how race had divided the two lawmakers.
And I felt sick to my stomach, very upset.
The bill stalled. A few weeks later, six temp agencies and one of their lobbyists donated campaign funds to Representative Arroyo. The total was $5,250. We asked Arroyo about this. He denied that the money he got was a thank you present for opposing the bill.
They wanted to take me out to dinner, and they all gave a check. And that's a norm for us over here on the north side. I've always supported temp agencies because it works in the northwest side. Right? So you got to support the people who support you.
Okay, so that's what happened last year in the legislature. Now Leone's group is trying again. It's working with lawmakers who've introduced a new bill. To get it passed, Leone says he'll need to raise another army, this time with Latino workers playing a bigger role. Leone meets with a dozen temps in a small apartment in Cicero, a mostly Latino suburb near Chicago. I was allowed in if I agreed not to use their names. He tells the workers how the anti-discrimination bill stalled.
Y solo tenemos a todos los latinos o muchos latinos unidos en nuestra lucha, no vamos a ganar.
He says if Latino temps don't unite with black temps, they won't make progress against stuff like wage theft and sexual harassment. Most of the workers at this meeting say they'll do it. They'll join forces with the African Americans. This woman says she'll help. She's a single mother who works through a staffing agency at a candy factory. After the meeting, though, I catch up with her outside, and she doesn't sound so sure about it. She says the factory is already replacing Latinos with African Americans. She says that's ever since some black temps brought a class action lawsuit against the company. The woman's worried how all this anti-discrimination campaigning will affect Latino workers like her. So I had to ask Leone something. It's about the sacrifice he's asking the Latinos to make, to give up their status as the preferred workers among the city's blue-collar temps, to give more opportunities to black workers. Many of these Latino temps are living hand-to-mouth. How can you ask them to risk their jobs?
What we're asking people to do is consider a strategy that we sincerely believe is beneficial to African Americans and Latinos in the long run. It would be great if we could do this a different way, but history shows us that social change necessarily has a certain amount of sacrifice in it.
There's a little station here on Chicago's southwest side where you can get on a bus with bright gold stripes. You can get on and go all the way to Central Mexico. Right next door, there's this storefront. It's an office of one of the state's biggest temp agencies. And Leone Bicchieri gets to talk with a stream of workers.
It's payday at Elite Staffing, and what I'm doing today is handing out some literature here, some in English, some in Spanish.
He hands a leaflet to a young woman.
Estamos promoviendo los derechos de los trabajadores temporales.
She seems in a hurry and walks on.
You know, a lot of times when I'm pushing this racial unity, it gets frustrating.
When he's feeling that way, Leone says, he often remembers his stepfather.
And I still remember that day when I was a little kid, laughing at those racial jokes.
He remembers his stepfather's lesson about who wins when poor people are divided. If Leone's group manages to get legislation passed, it could be the first law in the country aimed at stopping discrimination in temporary staffing.
So I'm not going to give up. Gary wouldn't want it, and I don't want it.
That story is from Chip Mitchell of WBEZ in Chicago. One last thing. A staffing firm in Chicago sued Leone Bicchieri for defamation. The company claimed that he and the Chicago Workers Collaborative are out to destroy the city's temp agencies. The company that filed that suit is also facing lawsuits brought by workers who say they were victims of discrimination. When we come back, America's long battle over jobs and justice.
If you don't have a job, you can't support your family, you can't pay for some extra education, you can't buy a good meal, it certainly is going to affect your freedom.
That's next on Reveal.
Hello, it's Ike Srikandaraja from Reveal. We're currently working on an episode around the theme of lawless lands, and we need your help. We want to hear about the places in your life where there are no rules, the places where you feel like you can get away with anything. A substitute teacher's first day, a mosh pit at a punk show, an amateur hockey game with no referee, a place in the middle of nowhere where no one is looking. So to help us out, record a voice memo about your lawless place. You can use the voice memo app on your phone. If you can, get a recording of the sound in the place itself and tell us why it's lawless to you. Don't forget to include your name and where you're recording from. Once you're done, save it and email it to lawless@cironline.org. We'll take a listen and include a few of your recordings in our upcoming episode. That email again, lawless@cironline.org. Thanks.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. All this hour, we've been looking at job discrimination across the country, especially in the temp industry. It locks people out of work and deepens the economic divide.
If you look at black people today, the net worth of the average black family is a little over $6,000. The net worth of a white family is over $91,000.
That's Clifford Alexander. Alexander is 82. He served four presidents and was the first African-American to chair the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, just 2 years after it opened in 1965.
Those figures I gave you are today's figures, not yesterday's figures. So it is still an act of economic discrimination to keep people from job opportunities.
Here's the thing about race. We don't like to talk about it. America would prefer to ignore the issue until something hits the news cycle that demands our attention. But the only way to make change is to deal with the facts. Clifford Alexander has been dealing with the facts since he was a young man. When he was still in his 20s, he went to work in the White House for President John F. Kennedy, just as the civil rights movement was heating up. When hundreds of thousands of people marched on Washington in 1963, Alexander was there to hear the speeches.
We want employment, and with it, we want the pride and responsibility and self-respect that goes with equal access to jobs.
The march itself was a glorious, glorious thing. I was there with my wife, Adele, and our daughter, Elizabeth, was in a stroller at the time.
He was also reporting back to Kennedy's advisors at the White House.
The president was somewhat skeptical as to what would take place, was then making a decision as to meet with the leadership of the march. Fortunately, he did do this.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up.
You know, the speech by Martin Luther King is so iconic and beautiful, but I think what happens is that that speech gets remembered and then the idea that the march was actually about jobs and freedom kind of gets left behind.
The jobs and freedom part actually are not coincidental. They are connected. If you don't have a job, you don't have any economic wherewithal, you can't support your family, you can't pay for some extra education, you can't buy a good meal, it certainly is going to affect your freedom.
Three months after the March on Washington, JFK was assassinated. Alexander began working for Lyndon Johnson. He was trying to get a divided Congress to approve the Civil Rights Act, which would guarantee equal opportunities in the workplace. One of the bill's biggest opponents was Richard Russell, a Democratic senator from Georgia. His fight against civil rights went back decades.
And they're trying to use this cry of economic opportunity to strike down the system of separation of the races.
This is Russell in the 1950s, speaking out against an earlier bill banning job discrimination.
This bill, of course, strikes down a fundamental and sacred civil right, and that is the right of a man to choose his own associates in business.
what you heard from Richard Russell was the swan song of bigoted people who saw in themselves, because they were white, a superiority to somebody who wasn't. That is a constant, unfortunately, in American and worldwide society, that the color of your skin can affect how you are regarded.
Richard Russell led one of the longest filibusters in Senate history, but Johnson won and Congress passed the Civil Rights Act. Alexander was there when the president signed the historic bill into law on July 2nd, 1964.
Let us lay aside irrelevant differences and make our nation whole.
When he signed that act, it was the culmination of what so many of us, including my late parents and millions of other people, white and black, of goodwill, did in this society.
There were some big compromises, compromises that still resonate today. The act outlawed job discrimination based on race, color, national origin, religion, and sex. And it created an agency to enforce the ban, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So far, so good. But lawmakers did something else. They ensured that the commission had no power to force companies to end discrimination. Even so, the law was a lightning rod in the presidential election of 1964.
Hello, Mr. President. Have a good day.
This is audio of President Johnson speaking with his national security advisor, McGeorge Bundy. Johnson is angry about a newspaper ad put out by the Goldwater campaign.
I got a fine-looking, honest, clean, pink-cheeked boy. I got fired under him in a square right under him. And they've got an arrogant-looking Negro boy with his teeth showing, grinning. Say, hired. And say, employee, read this. You can lose your job because Johnson Civil Rights Bill, this is your last chance. Vote to put an end to racial favoritism. Vote to protect your job. Vote to protect your family. Vote to protect your home. Employers, read this. This is your last chance. Save your freedom. Run your own business as you choose.
Well, that was the President Johnson I knew. He loved to feel sorry for himself and all that he was fighting for. But it does tell you a lot about the candidate on the other side. Goldwater was a bigot. We need to call bigots bigots. And when you run that kind of stuff, and that was a great part of their campaign, it does tell you what it was like in America in 1964.
So Goldwater lost the 64 election. Johnson stayed in office. And in 1965, the EEOC opened its doors. It was a huge victory. Now there was hope that jobs were open to everyone.
Girls, have you got the kind of man everyone looks up to?
That's the Supremes. That song was written for them, part of a PR campaign led by big business and supported by the government. They wanted to convince minorities that discrimination was over.
There was a time when the world was fickle and it may have been hard to succeed. But times have changed now and school and training is all you really need.
But it wasn't that simple. In 1967, President Johnson appointed Clifford Alexander to lead the EEOC. Alexander wanted the commission to have real enforcement authority like other federal agencies, cease and desist powers, to order businesses to stop discriminating, but Congress wouldn't budge. So the commission had no teeth. Alexander figured if he couldn't order companies to end discrimination, at least he could shame them. He called public hearings. In New York, he went after advertising agencies and the media for excluding women and minorities. In Los Angeles, he targeted the defense industry, financial companies, and Hollywood.
And the real story was that they never received the kind of opportunities that they should according to their skills and talents. It was, at that time, a step-and-fetch-it, tap-dancing image of black people that was conveyed by the movie industry. And again, this is what creates the image of us.
Alexander's tactics enraged conservative lawmakers. The Republican leader of the Senate, Everett Dirksen, publicly accused him of harassing businesses.
And because I was something of a smartass, I said to him, if that's the charge, I plead guilty. And the Senator Dirksen said, somebody in this room should be fired. Well, I was the somebody that should be fired. And President Nixon, in his grand way, decided that I should not be head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. One of the great treasures of my life is that I made the Nixon's enemies list.
Three years later, Congress did give the EEOC authority to sue companies. Alexander says that didn't go far enough, and lawmakers should give the commission more power and more resources. But in the end, he says, it's up to employers, especially large corporations, to tackle workplace discrimination.
I haven't heard any of the Fortune 500 or any other significant high-level white business executive take this on as his or her most important issue. They take on the issue of the environment. They take on the issue of international affairs, but they do not take on this issue with the severity and seriousness that they should.
After heading the EEOC, Clifford Alexander became the first black man to serve as Secretary of the Army. That was under Jimmy Carter. He was also a law partner, a TV commentator, and a business consultant. And today, he continues his lifelong effort to champion equal opportunities in the workplace. We're going to tell you about next week's show in a minute, but first, thanks to WBEZ in Chicago and reporter Chip Mitchell for working with us on this show. Our lead producer was Michael Montgomery. Will Evans reported on the show with senior editor and new daddy, Fernando Diaz. Our senior radio editor is Deb George. Our radio staff includes Stan Alcorn, Fernanda Camarena, Julia B. Chan, Rachel DeLeon, Cheryl Duvall, Peter Hayden, Mwenda Hasey, Catherine Miskowski, David Richard, Nina Satija, Michael Schiller, Ike Sriskandaraja, Laura Starcheski, Taki Telenitis, and Amy Walters. Our sound design team is the Wonder Twins, my man, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Claire C. Note Mullen. Our editor-in-chief is Amy Pyle, and Krista Scharfenberg is our head of studio. Suzanne Reber's Reveal's executive editor. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Next week, we'll look at a high-tech system police departments are using to stop crime. It's called ShotSpotter.
You know, ultimately, it came down to a decision of, do you want to keep this system, or do you want to hire another police officer?
But police don't always end up making arrests, so some cities are wondering if it's worth the expense. That story next week. Support for Reveals provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Ledson, and remember, there is always more to the story.